The title, of course, he just mentioned, The Image of God, and its scriptural setting. The presentation outline is really a Genesis 1 summarized, and we cover the various aspects of Genesis 1. There's a lot to cover in a short period of time, but we'll go through them quickly, and we'll finally end up looking at the image of God, which is also in the 8th episode of Genesis 1. Fundamental doctrine, the most important theological doctrine of Christian faith, is a belief in the inerrancy of Scripture. Unless the infallibility of Scripture is truly acknowledged, the Christian faith lacks a reliable foundation. And without trust in the written word, theological truth claims are just empty assertions. However, in no way is the inerrancy of interpretation implied. Interpretation of Scripture will always be subject to human fallibility. In the creation of the universe, of course, we're all familiar with the Genesis 1:1, but at the beginning of creation, God created the fundamental parameters of nature, including gravity, the atomic binding forces, and the dynamic relationships of space-time and energy-matter. By the year 2013, man-made space satellites have mapped a precise pattern, a signature, of the Big Bang-generated cosmic microwave background radiation pattern. And analysis of the data show that the creation occurred 13.82 billion years ago. But quite a while ago, our solar system formed in the Milky Way galaxy, including first the Sun, later the Earth, and the other planets, then the Moon, plus a great number of asteroids. But the Earth's initial condition was that without form and darkness was over the face of the deep. But as the early Earth cooled from its molten state, its outer surface solidified a thick crust and a dense primordial cloud cover began to dissipate. And the density of cloud, as it decreased, sunlight was able to penetrate to the surface of the Earth. The Earth continued to undergo extensive geological and atmospheric changes, and eventually its surface became completely covered with water. About 3.9 billion years ago, as the Earth's physical transformation progressed, God created organic life, at first simple in form, but exquisite in design. Radiated energy from the sun created an evaporation-type water cycle between the water in the oceans below and the water in the clouds above. The Earth's molten and fluid interior mantle acted on the outer crust to create emerging landmasses, which formed in the slow migrating plates. The Earth's atmosphere gradually became oxygen-rich and transparent, which enabled all forms of life, energized by the sun, to flourish. And here we have the transformed Earth. The earth was filled with vegetation growing on the land, birds flying in the air, fish swimming in the oceans, and animals roaming the land, and human beings created in the image of God. Now, how should the biblical creation account be interpreted? The creation of the universe in Genesis 1:1 does not seem to present a widespread problem of interpretation. But the transformation of the earth in the rest of Genesis 1 has historically presented a scientific and theological challenge. It's instructive to critically review two popular interpretations. The creation day view. I have no doubt most of you are familiar with this particular view. It's 6 days with various things happening during those days. And I'll make some comments at the bottom. There are two variations of this view, of course. Many believe the days are 24-hour periods, but others interpret the days as long periods of time. So they have the same pattern, but it's a different interpretation. But actually, the Earth's transformation did not occur in six discrete segments. And the days referenced in the refrain really designate the work days of man. But the sequence of days does establish a relationship between the pattern of man's living and God's creative work. But the second view that came along later was a framework view, where there's two triads of forming and filling, and people noticed the relationship of the first 3 days of forming with the second 3 days of filling. So they came up with this framework view, and it kind of eliminated the need for understanding how long the day was. But it's an interesting theme, but the living pattern of man is completely ignored. The scheme also disregards a sequential nature of the narrative. But let's look at the structure of Genesis 1. Beginning with 1:3, the creation narrative is organized into 8 episodes that collectively describe the transformation of the earth and its filling with life. These 8 episodes represent the principal aspects of a very long, God-ordained evolutionary creation process. Each of the episodes is presented according to a four-part format: command, confirmation that it happened, explanation given, more detail, and God's assessment. God saw that it was very good. Based on this structure, a new and better interpretation of Genesis 1 is called for. And that interpretation incorporates a creative episode perspective. And here it's recognizing this perspective recognizes the 8 episodes that are described in Genesis 1. Then these episodes, there's day 1. These 6 days are inserted into the narrative. And of course, the question is, what are those days? The 8 episodes of making and filling of the earth are the principal aspects of an evolutionary creation process that extended over a period of 4.6 billion years. The 6 days sequentially inserted into the narrative specify the work days of man, and this understanding becomes clear when the context of the refrain is analyzed. So let's look at the refrain. Of course, it starts off at 1 day, a second day, a third day, and so forth. The verse syntax includes the use of two verbs, which means that the evening and morning terms are the successive events that mark the beginning and ending of the nighttime period of an ordinary earth day. Thus, the context of the refrain is man-centered, and instead of implying days of creation, the refrain denotes the nighttime rest periods of man's work week. Insertion of the 6-day refrain into the creation narrative reveals God's genius because it illustrates that man's biological clock and his specified living pattern are designed to be in conformity with the Earth's 24-hour rotational period. Thus, the refrain accomplishes two purposes: one, specification of the living pattern of mankind, and two, to establish a relationship of man's living pattern with God's creation. Now, this relationship is formalized in one of the explanatory verses of the fourth commandment, which also provides the basis of a Sabbath day observance. And this is a very familiar verse. since the verse references the earth's transformation and not Genesis 1:1, the phrase heaven and earth should be understood to mean sky and land. Secondly, the preposition in is placed in brackets because an equivalent word does not appear in the Hebrew text. Its insertion is a misleading translation. Theologian John C. Collins explains that Exodus 20:11 and 39:17 refer to the creation account, but are intended to emphasize the relationship between God's work week and the living pattern of man, which includes the observance of a Sabbath day of rest. Genesis 1 summary, just looking at all that, what we talked about. The transformation of the earth is illustrated by a series of 8 episodes which are presented in the form of royal decrees. Each verse of the six-day refrain, a nighttime period, and intent is to specify the living pattern of man. And it does not provide a time duration, short or long, for any part of the creation process. God's resting on the seventh day provides a symbolic basis for man's Sabbath day of rest. So here we have God, who is the creator of nature and the inspiration for Scripture. And naturally there is harmony between the two. But man is involved in science and also in theology. Now, science is the exegesis of nature, and theology is the exegesis of Scripture. But they're both subject to human interpretation. From science, we have archaeology that past human activity gives us trace evidence on nature, and we have the extra-biblical literature influences a literary style of Scripture. But because of the immutability, immensity, and infinity of God, it is unreasonable to expect that these lofty characteristics would be imparted, even partially, with the subjects of God's creation, with the objects. Therefore, to understand what it means to be created in the image of God, attention must be directed toward the literary style of Genesis 1 and the context of the Genesis 1, 26, 28 verses, instead of engaging in philosophical and theological speculation. Royal metaphor style of writing was common, telling stories of creation and the role that various gods played in how the ancients thought the world was created. Although the biblical writers were inspired by God, their divine direction was accomplished in a manner that not only retained their personal style of writing, but also what they wrote reflected the literary style common at the time. Genesis 1:26, indeed the whole creation narrative, should be seen in this light. Now, looking at the 8th creative episode, we have Genesis 1:26. Notice dominion over the fish and all things. Very comprehensive verse. Then in 1:27, in the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And in 1:28, and God blessed them, said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish and all the things. Now, there's only 2 other explicit references to God's image in the Old Testament. Genesis 5:1 says, in the book of Generations of Adam, when God created man, he made him in his likeness. And then in 9:26, again, these are very familiar verses, made man in his own image. Now, some commentators have noted that the scarcity of biblical references contributes to a wide diversity of opinion over what it means to be made in the image of God. Other Old Testament verses use the Hebrew word tselem, image, and demut, likeness, to convey either a sculptured image or an abstract likeness. However, such a word study is inconclusive to determine the meaning of Imago Dei in Genesis 1. I have a lot of trouble with that Latin. Should not be sought in terms of metaphysical analogy between the human soul and the being of God. Instead, the context of Genesis 1:26 points to rule as the purpose of God's declaration. The author provides a proper interpretive approach by his use of the royal metaphor style of writing to describe God's creative activity. He uses eight and God said episodes to describe the transformation of the earth and its filling with life. These episodes are presented as a series of let there be royal decrees that are pronounced by a ruler king. The concept of rule is emphasized again in that the creation of mankind in God's image refers to God's delegation of power to humanity to have dominion over the rest of creation. Robert Davidson, in his book Genesis 1:11, adopts this interpretation when he writes, "The image and likeness are defined by what follows in Genesis 1:26, and that is to rule. Genesis 1:27 further emphasizes the concept of dominion by declaring that humans were biologically created as male and female, blessed them with fertility, and commissioned by God to reproduce and fill the earth and subdue it." Richard Middleton gives an excellent definition of the image in his book, A Liberating Image, the Imago Dei in Genesis 1. "The image of God is a mandate-given responsibility rather than a physical or spiritual characteristics imparted to the nature of humankind. Since God's image has been given to all mankind, such a responsibility is quite distinct from the goal of born-again Christians to become more and more conformed to the image of Christ." The image of God, it's not so much what man is like, but what responsibility mankind has been given and how this God-given mandate should be fulfilled. And here we have the Genesis 1 world, and in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the land produced living creatures. So God created man in his own image, and God saw that it was very good. It was God who created the world, and on earth, man is his representative. That's the literal message of Genesis 1. I had a hard time keeping up with it, but I had needed to stay within the 20 minutes.
Is it possible to get a copy of that?
Well, there's a PDF version. The PDF version does not have animation. It just the complete slide, but it's there. I didn't quite hear you, but I think that this is part of the theological speculation. we think about the image of Christ and so forth, and we relate that to the image of God. And the image of God that created all mankind is a responsibility. It's a mandate given to mankind. They're separate. They're not the same. Well, of course, Jesus was the ultimate image of God, no question about that.
As an affirmation of what you said and an expression of gratitude, more than that, it's certainly not intended to be a criticism of the conference. I wish we had started with your presentation. When the conference started. Thank you for that. As I was listening to it, I was thinking two things. One, a real affirmation of some biblical scholarship on the priestly author, the co-authorship of Genesis. You're in line with a long line of biblical scholarship.
That's good company to be in.
Yeah, it is. Well, yeah, maybe. But anyway, in any case, there's some validation there. So just to give you that piece of kindling, just to add fuel to the fire. There's also a piece, I think, of confirmation in science of systems that's emerging, and particularly complex adaptive systems and the emergence between order and chaos. And the episodic interpretation of Genesis 1 seems to be very much in line with the new and emerging science of emergence in complex systems. So it's just another connection.
In my studying of Genesis 1, I think we've gone on the wrong track by concentrating on the days. If you asked a question, does Genesis 1 teach the living pattern of man? And where does it teach it? You come to the conclusion it's the refrain that teaches the weekly pattern of man. And we're not to associate those days with the days of creation. If you look at the verses in Scripture that use the word day, it's used 11 times. The first five times, it's obviously talking about a day on earth that man will experience as he lives on earth. The other six times are in the 6 days of the refrain. And when you analyze the refrain, as Collins and other have, they say it's the nighttime rest period of a man. And again, the context is man's pattern, not creation. So we've gotten so locked in on what are the days, how long are they, and of course the framework view said, hey, we're not going to deal with days, we're going to look at the other pattern. And it's a nice pattern, but it doesn't have anything to do with teaching the living pattern for man.
Scientific perspective, because they can preserve this idea that there's a spiritual component to humanity, that is a concept outside of science. You cannot prove or disprove it by science. It's something, I like to use the word protected from science, but it is beyond science. And so there's no kind of God of the gaps here that would deter science from investigating. It would just be recognizing that the creation of man is very unique and different than the other organisms.
Well, that's where, to define what the image of God is, you've got to go to the Genesis 1 verses. And they're clear that man has been created in God's image, and he's a representative of God on earth. It's a tremendous job, but it's to rule and be a good steward, so forth. But we have wanted to search for some characteristic that God has given us different from the animals. But that's not what Genesis 1 is teaching. It doesn't go in that direction.
One more question. How do you think about the image of God with respect to situations like anencephalic children or severely demented individuals with severe dementia or who have suffered severe brain trauma?
Well, they would just be limited in how they would fulfill that image, but they still can have a testimony. But obviously, someone who's intellectually depraved can't fulfill God's image the way in a full extent.